Are there any questions from the audience?
Hello, this is a question for Dr. Murphy. Just here. I'm just interested in how you derived the cutoff scores for the clinical scales that you use, the PCS and the PSE and the PASS.
Yeah, I guess you would ask that one. I mean, there's no paper there. That's based on our experience from the pain management service. And again, we have several pain programs there, and sort of looking at our history, how we manage distress, and sort of from that, that's about over 1,000 patients there, looking at outcomes. And we sort of, the pain catastrophizing, for example, that is from Mick Sullivan's original paper of 35 onwards, is a warning sign that something needs to be done. The other ones are fairly high, like the Beck depression inventory. We've got a 24. Now, some programs wouldn't accept a patient on at the program with 24. We tend to try and be an inclusive program. Sometimes, you know, that patient would go for individual therapy, but we've got about 18-20% on the pain management program with score over 24. And we know they're a challenge, and we see that with the spinal cord, or person being considered for spinal cord stimulation, we know that that level of distress is likely to have a significant impact on particularly self-management in terms of the adherence to goals, because that's one of the best predictors. Fear avoidance and depression are going to interfere with their advice from the physio about doing their own exercise, whatever. Because that's, as someone else mentioned, patients know what they're about after a while. They're bright people, but the hardest bit is sticking to it and keeping up with it. And depression tends to sap people's energy and confidence, and that's why we need to get that sorted, really, before we'd go ahead with, say, consider a trial.
Okay, thank you. Other questions? Yes. Kevin?
Can I ask Christine, please, that I understand, I think, how and why you developed your service in primary care. What I'd really like to know is, have you done any audit of the outcomes? Has your service changed things for the better? Has it not changed at all? Can you answer?
We have some audit data of the outcomes of the primary care clinic. We haven't actually looked at outcome data of patients that have gone on from primary care into secondary care, and to see whether that's had an impact on how those patients' outcomes, you know, at the end of their treatment. The outcome data from the primary care clinic shows that we've got, I think it's about a 65% discharge rate up to 12 months of patients, with approximately 40 to 50% relief on their initial scores. We have had very little numbers of patients coming back into the service, which I think is a fairly good predictor of how well we've done or how well we've managed them.
Thank you for that. Is that data available anywhere?
Not something that we've published or something that we've... It's just audit data that we've got from the clinics at the moment. No, I haven't actually done anything.
That's a good outcome. And the reason behind the question is that in England, many of these clinics are set up for financial reasons, by primary care trusts looking for ways of saving money. What's never been clear in a country which doesn't have that kind of commissioning process is whether or not it does materially affect the outcome. And I'd be really grateful if I could get sight of your figures.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Also for Christian, if you don't mind. Having worked in Manchester, I know the size of the population there and the number of patients I'm sure you deal with. You do two clinics a week for the whole of that area. Have you got any suggestions how one can improve efficiency, for example, of triaging patients? Because if you spend more than 1 hour per patient, you're only, you know, sadly only getting to a small number of people.
I think the efficiency could be improved in the triage process if we could get the triage forms back earlier, and that we could see those forms to triage the patients before the patients come to the clinic. The forms that we've developed are very comprehensive. There's a lot of information on them, and it would save a lot of time in clinic. And looking at the remodelling of the secondary care service at the moment, that is going to be an issue as well. And that's been an issue within secondary care, and that's why we're looking at setting up now our clinic with a nurse assessment as the first patient's appointment in secondary care. Again, quite controversial because of payment by results, that we're getting our hit for a nurse assessment rather than a consultant's clinic. But we feel that a lot of our problems at the moment around the regional booking management services and the call centres, and they just mess our clinics up constantly. We have patients turning up in clinic that we've never seen a referral letter for. We have patients turning up in clinic that have never been triaged by one of our clinicians. And we have patients at DNA, and when we speak to them, they've never had a letter inviting them to the clinic. So the call centre and the booking management centre are our biggest problem. If we've got across the board clinic with 8 new patient slots for the nurses to see, that doesn't necessarily need to be a triage, because that is the triage process. So it gives us the onus back on triaging our own patients rather than that being done through. And they will just be choose and book, it'll be open to choose and book fully, whereas at the moment we can't do that because, again, that causes us great problems. So the triage process and the getting the triage form back or doing it yourself in clinic, I think, would make that better.
Leslie.
Question for Stephen. Alex, what suggestions would you have for differentiation between patients with addiction and patients with pseudo-addiction, which I have to say I find very problematic in clinical practice?
Thanks, Leslie. I think pseudo-addiction is a real problem. I find all this literature on opiates really confusing. That in my clinical experience, they work for a lot of chronic pains and for neuropathic pain, but on a population basis, it doesn't seem to be effective, and that's probably a problem with selection, isn't it? I think that we've been over-enthusiastic about using them. I think that if you're not sure of whether you have an opiate-sensitive pain and you're not giving enough, then I would bring patients in for an infusion test and round them up with alfentanil to as high a dose as I was getting side effects, find out whether they'd had any opiate effect.
Do you think that will actually differentiate between the two groups of patients if you've got someone who's
potentially
addicted to a large dose of intravenous opiate?
I think the other thing is you want to find out whether you've got other psychosocial factors that are going on. I think that's probably what Ali was going to say.
Yeah. In a way, I'm a firm believer of second opinion and taking time. And you know, clinics like the pain independence clinics are very much based, and even if there's no chronic pain specialists in the clinics themselves, they're very much based upon the notion of what is the right treatment. So there are people who I have increased their methadone, for example, because they have substance misuse problems and pain problems, rather than starting on the notion is this pseudo addiction or addiction, with the confidence that I have, as Steve, you know, a good history and a good examination. And of course, reviewing the whole situation. There is a lot of theoretical knowledge about the fact that, or literature about the fact that judgment and attitudes tend to influence how many people you have in your clinic which have pseudo-addiction or not, or who are actually in pain and not treated adequately as well. And there's that body of literature which we're currently investigating in Dundee University.
Another question? I've got a question also for Stephen and Alec. Kind of one of the big problems is what you refer to opioid phobia. So kind of if I think about using or having a trial of opioids for patients, I have to convince them first, because often patients are very worried about addiction. Now, and I always tell them, don't worry. Kind of if you take opioids for medical reasons, it won't happen. Now, can I say that? Or am I kind of, do you see patients who are clearly by pain specialists, have been given opioids, and you see them a few years down the line being addicted?
A few years ago I read a paper by Ron Melzack called The Tragedy of Needless Pain, which was in Scientific American, and it swung my really very strongly in the view that addiction would be very uncommon, and it quoted the Boston Burns Hospital, where they reckoned that it was 10 times more likely that doctors who were working there would become addicted to opiates than the patients who were treated. but then more recently, there have been some, again from the Danish experience, I reckon an instance of addiction or dependence problems maybe in 5% of patients who you're giving long-term.
I mean, 5.
1 in 20. And so I think that you know, the early enthusiasm is being tempered by the longer term results. I was wondering whether I could ask the audience a question. Actually, it was out of the people who are running clinics and prescribe strong opiates for chronic pain, how many of you would arrange a regular review for your patients on strong opiates, and would you have them on a register? And I think that's the Pain Society recommendations. So I think that we maybe have to be cautious, and I speak from a position of having been very enthusiastic for the use of opiates for chronic long-term pain.
It's not really an answer to your question, but it's a kind of supplementary thing. Jane Ballantyne reviewed this last year, I think, at the beginning of this year, and she highlighted the notion that the evidence for using strong opioids chronically stops at about 7 or 8 months. And so my question is, would you put a time limit on it? Would you infer from that that the benefit of opioids is time limited, and would you put a limit on it?
Is that for me again? Well, I think I have to speak from the position of being a sinner, that I send patients back to the GP and I hope that they'll look after them.
And I think this is the notion of therapeutic boundaries, which I think there was a recommendation, one of your sort of learned journals, about mandates and being very clear what you can do and what you can do, but also having a contract with the patient and other agencies involved in the care of the patient and the case itself, to be very clear, yeah, how long would you be involved in and for what reason. I think going back to coming from a psychiatrist who works in primary care in the community, is that I'm always amazed that people or doctors are very happy to prescribe opioids, but not very clear to make a diagnosis of chronic pain or type of chronic pain that would justify the right type of medication. And I'm always surprised that that is lost in the wilderness of the phobia and all the sort of bits and pieces that needs to be done, including the interventions, other interventions. A review, a follow-up, but usually, again, putting my psychiatric hat, is something doesn't work after 6 months. I think you need to question your original diagnosis.
Food for thought. Any other questions? Well, it looks like the Friday weekend evening is starting. Well, thank you very much, and I'm sure you will join me in thanking all our speakers.